business have asked me where I came up with the 2% formula. And the truth is, I just pulled it out of the air. In the early days, most companies charged 5% of their sales to run their offices. But we have always operated lean. We have operated with fewer people. We have had our people do more than in other companies. I think we came to work earlier and stayed later. It has been our heritage, our obsession, that we would be more productive and more efficient than our competition. And we've accomplished that goal. A lot of first-time visitors are kind of shocked by our executive offices. Most people say my office and those of all the other Walmart executives look like something you'd find in a truck terminal. We're in a one-story office warehouse building. The offices aren't real big, and the walls are covered with inexpensive paneling. We never had fancy furniture or thick carpet or suites with bars for our executives. I like them just like they are. We sure as heck won't win any interior decorating awards, but they're all we need, and they must be working fine. Just ask our shareholders. David Glass. If you don't zero in on your bureaucracy every so often, you will naturally build in layers. You never set out to add bureaucracy. You just get it, period, without even knowing it. So you always have to be looking to eliminate it. You know, when Tim Watson Sr. was running IBM, he decided they would never have more than four layers from the chairman of the board to the lowest level in the company. That may have been one of the greatest single reasons why IBM was successful. A lot of this goes back to what Deming told the Japanese a long time ago. Do it right the first time. The natural tendency when you've got a problem in a company is to come up with a solution to fix it. Too often that solution is nothing more than adding another layer. What you should be doing is going to the source of the problem to fix it. And sometimes that requires shooting the culprit. I'll give you an example that just drove Sam crazy until we started doing something about it. When merchandise came into the back of a store, it was supposed to be marked at the right price or marked correctly on the spot. But because it often wasn't getting done properly, we created positions called test scanners. People who go around the stores with handheld scanners, making sure everything is priced correctly. There's another layer right there. And Sam didn't ever visit a store without asking if we really needed these folks. Well, we still have some. But what we've done is overhaul our back office procedures to make sure we get it right more often the first time. And in the process, we eliminated 1.5 people out of the office in every Walmart store in the company. That's big bucks. Really, it's a pretty simple philosophy. What you have to do is just draw a line in the dirt and force the bureaucracy back behind that line. And then know for sure that a year will go by and it will be back across that line, and you'll have to do the same thing again. I guess one reason I feel so strongly about not letting egos get out of control around Walmart is that a lot of bureaucracy is really the product of some empire builder's ego. Some folks have a tendency to build up big staffs around them to emphasize their own importance, and we don't need any of that at Walmart. If you're not serving the customer or supporting the folks who do, we don't need you. When we're thinking small, that's another thing we're always on the lookout for, big egos. You don't have to have a small ego to work here, but you'd better know how to make it look small, or you might wind up in trouble. So you see what I mean when I say you have to think small to grow big? And really, I don't have any doubt that Walmart will stay the course and reach $100 billion in sales by the year 2000. It's a challenge. Nothing like it has ever been done before. But our folks will do it. And now I'm going to confess to a really radical thought I've been having lately. I probably won't do anything about it, but the folks who come after me are eventually going to have to face up to this question. Even by thinking small, can a $100 billion retailer really function as efficiently and productively as it should? Or would maybe five $20 billion companies work better? Chapter 16. Giving Something Back. I believe that every right implies a responsibility, every opportunity an obligation, every possession a duty. John D. Rockefeller, Jr. By now, I've given you a pretty clear impression of what my business priorities have been over the years. If I have explained myself well, you know that I have concentrated all along on building the finest retailing company that we possibly could. Period. Creating a huge personal fortune was never particularly a goal of mine, and the proof of that lies in the fact that even to this day, most of my and my family's wealth remains in the form of Walmart stock. I think most people in our position would have hedged their bets a long time ago and diversified into all kinds of investments. As it happened, though, our very simplistic, very personal investment strategy has turned out far better than anyone could ever have expected. So Walmart stock has made the Waltons a very wealthy family. On paper, anyway. I won't deny for a second that my approach has been single-minded. I've concentrated on keeping our Walmart stores and Sam's Clubs on track, and I have to admit that I never have spent a great deal of my time or energy thinking about what some of the broader implications of our family's wealth could be. Maybe it's because we have never had any intention of liquidating our stock. Even so, the annual dividend income from that stock has become large in its own right, and it's that income which represents the actual wealth available to us. As I told you early on, this kind of wealth seems to naturally attract all kinds of folks who just want us to give them a handout. We've never been inclined to give any undeserving stranger a free ride, and we will never change our minds about that. Nor do we believe that because we have money, we should be called upon to solve every personal problem that comes to our attention, every problem of the community, the state, or for that matter, the country. We do, however, believe in worthy causes, and we realize how fortunate we've been as a family. So we are committed to using our personal resources for as much benefit as possible. In the areas we feel need the most help, employing the methods we think hold the most promise. And our family's gifts reflect a wide variety of interests, spread across numerous organizations, with a heavy emphasis on education. Most of the giving we have done has been either anonymously or linked to strict request for no publicity, and I'm not going to go into the financial details of our charitable activities here, because I don't think it's anybody's business but our own. I will tell you, though, that we think we do our part. In addition to a lot of educational institutions, recipients of Walton family gifts include church groups and community projects like zoos and libraries and recreation facilities. We support hospitals and medical research programs. We fund arts groups and theater groups and symphonies. We give to conservation and environmental causes and veterans groups, as well as to economic development groups and free enterprise groups. We support public schools and private schools. Since charity almost always begins at home, many of the recipients are in the communities or at institutions to which Helen and I, or our children, have personal ties. But we have also supported national organizations and even a few local causes of national importance in such cities as New York and Washington. Helen has been actively and publicly supportive of a number of institutions, including the Presbyterian Church, the University of the Ozarks, and the National Museum for Women in the Arts. And I have supported such groups as the Citizens Against Government Waste, Students in Free Enterprise, and the Arkansas Business Council, which folks around here insist on calling the Good Suit Club. We also have some pet projects to which Helen and I together are strongly and personally committed. In the last 10 years, we have funded a special scholarship program we started, which sends kids from Central America to college here in Arkansas. Right now, we've got about 180 of them enrolled at 3 different Arkansas schools, and we pay about $13,000 a year per student to provide tuition, transportation, books, and room and board. We got the idea while we were traveling around down in that part of the world. And when we learned that the then Soviet Union and Cuba had programs to teach their values to kids from other places, we decided Americans ought to be doing the same sort of thing with our values. We want kids to learn about the tremendous potential of the free enterprise system and to see for themselves what all the advantages are of a stable, democratic government. Besides that, it will help some of these students who wouldn't have otherwise received any college education to return to their countries and do something about their serious economic development problems. Who knows, maybe one day some of them will be running Walmarts or Sam's Clubs in Honduras or Panama or Guatemala, or even Nicaragua. Closer to home, the Walton family sponsors 70 scholarships of $6,000 each every year for children of Walmart associates. So we feel pretty good about what we've done up until now. But I do realize there's a bigger issue at stake here, and I've been doing a lot of thinking on it lately. As a family, we've been in the planning stages of how we want to leverage our resources for a while now, but really the serious business of getting it done will begin after I'm gone. Helen and I expect that an amount at least equal to our share of the family assets will go to nonprofit organizations over a number of years. In all likelihood, education is going to be the issue we focus on the most. It is the single area which causes me the most worry about our country's future. As a nation, we have already learned that we must compete worldwide with everybody else, and our educational process has more to do with our ability to compete successfully than anything else. Unless we get ourselves on the right track pretty quickly and start rebuilding our system into one that compares favorably with the rest of the world's, we could seriously jeopardize the future of this great country of ours. Frankly, I'd like to see an all-out revolution in education. We've got to target the inner-city schools and the rural poverty pockets like the Mississippi Delta and figure out a way to make a difference. We have to start at the preschool level and develop ways to change the environment for children so they have a chance to stay in school and learn to value their educations. We have to look at the effects of so many single mothers and fathers leaving their kids at home with no guidance, and find ways to help them encourage their kids. Incidentally, my share of the proceeds from this book will go to the New American School Corporation, which is a private initiative started by business leaders who have pledged to raise $200 million for the development of Break the Mold schools. It's a true nonpartisan effort aimed at helping American schools meet the 6 goals established by a National Governor's Task Force, which was convened by President Bush and chaired by Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton. As the family focuses more broadly on educational reform, we want to be very careful. We are devout believers in the Walmart way of doing things. and we want some basis by which to measure our investment. We're not satisfied that the traditional methods by which charitable foundations are operated really meet our criteria. Some people have crowed a great deal about all their philanthropy over the years, but too many of these foundations, I suspect, were only begun as tax shelters, without much real sense of purpose. Many of them seem to have become very nice places to work for a small group of folks who have built up pretty thick crusts of administration and bureaucracy. Those are two of the things we have fought the hardest to keep out of our company, so naturally we don't want them clogging up our non-profit efforts. We are going to insist that whatever program we support incorporates those same values. When it comes to college educations and scholarships, for example, I've always favored programs that require the recipients to work and kick in some of their own money. For that matter, I've always preferred to hire people who had to at least partly work their way through school, no doubt because of my own background. The secret lies in motivating kids who aren't getting educated today to want to put themselves through school, and to make them understand the rewards they can expect when they do. So we are going to approach philanthropy with the same lack of reverence we gave to the traditional methods of the retail business when we started out there. We are going to see if we can't shake up some of the time-honored assumptions about what you can teach people, about what you can do with people whose self-esteem has been beaten down, and about how you can motivate ordinary people to do extraordinary things. As just one example of the kinds of folks we're calling on in putting this effort together, we asked Lamar Alexander, the former governor of Tennessee and now U.S. Secretary of Education, to attend our last family meeting here in Bentonville and talk with us about some of the ideas he's come across for improving our public education system. We don't come by this passion for improving education out of some fuzzy-headed notion or something we read somewhere. We see the need every day at Walmart. In the old days, just being bright and willing to work hard was enough to give you all the opportunity you needed at our company. But we're such a sophisticated company today, and have moved so rapidly in the areas of technology and communications, that skill and knowledge in these fields have become a vital part of our business. None of this is news to anyone who keeps up with world business trends. This is the direction in which we're all headed. And to succeed, we're just going to have to do a better job of educating and training our workforce. One aspect of this whole philanthropy issue that has annoyed me considerably over the years is the criticism by some of our detractors that Walmart doesn't do its fair share of giving to charities. The criticism seems to come from folks who say we don't meet the standard guidelines for corporations, guidelines which are set, I guess, by the people who run the charity business. Walmart, like many other corporations, conducts a very aggressive United Way campaign which meets with great success among our associates every year. In fact, we keep our United Way gold sign in the yard right outside my office here, so everybody can see how we're doing. We strongly believe in United Way because, in spite of all the publicity it received recently for some problems in the national office, most all the money that's been collected in these campaigns is directed locally. We believe in locally directed charities. So we have a matching grant program for associates who want to raise money for charities of their choice. We're also a big contributor to the Children's Miracle Network Telethon, which supports locally directed children's hospitals. Last year, Walmart and its associates were the largest single contributors to this campaign, at $7.5 million. I think quite a few companies use charitable giving guidelines as a way to say, in effect, we gave at the office, when it comes to thinking about what overall good the company should be accomplishing. In my opinion, Walmart is an entirely different sort of enterprise from that, and I would argue that our relentless effort to improve our business has always been tied to trying to make things better for the folks who live and work in our communities. We have built a company that is so efficient, it has enabled us to save our customers billions of dollars. And whether you buy into the argument or not, we believe it. That in itself is giving something back. And it has been a cornerstone philosophy of our company. For example, we did $43 billion in sales this year. For the last 10 years, 1982 to 1992, we have averaged sales of, say, $13 billion a year. So that's about $130 billion in sales. If we only saved our customers 10% over what they would be paying if we weren't there, and I think that's very conservative, that would be $13 billion we've saved them. That's $13 billion, which is a product of a free market system that allows us to operate efficiently. And it's the reason our customers love us so. The truth is that Walmart has been a powerful force for improving the standard of living in our mostly rural trade areas, and our customers recognize it. We do a lot of things to take care of our own. Some of them you already know about. Our associates have almost $2 billion in their profit-sharing fund, some of which I suppose the company could have given to charity instead. We have a relief fund for associates who are the victims of natural disasters. And each year, every Walmart store sponsors one student in its community to a $1,000 scholarship. Beyond that, we feel very strongly that Walmart really is not and should not be in the charity business. We don't believe in taking a lot of money out of Walmart's cash registers and giving it to charity for the simple reason that any debit has to be passed along to somebody, either our shareholders or our customers. A few years ago, when Helen convinced me that our associates here in Bentonville needed a first-class exercise facility, she and I paid the $1 million in construction costs ourselves, plus an annual subsidy for a few years to get it started. We paid for it to show our sincere appreciation to the associates, but also because I don't believe in asking the customers or the shareholders to pay for something like that, as worthy a cause as it may be. By not designating a large amount of corporate funds to some charity which the officers of Walmart may happen to like, we feel we give our shareholders more discretion in supporting their own charities. And I have been particularly proud of the really generous community support shown by some of our shareholders who have been with us since way back when, especially the early store managers. Willard Walker and Charlie Baum are two guys who have just done great things for the community with some of what they've accumulated through their Walmart holdings. Maybe the most important way in which we at Walmart believe in giving something back is through our commitment to using the power of this enormous enterprise as a force for change. One of the better examples of what I'm talking about is our Bring It Home to the USA program, which we started in 1985 in response to the soaring U.S. trade deficit. Walmart, like every other American retailer, is a huge importer of merchandise from overseas. In some cases, too many in my opinion, importing is really our only alternative because a lot of American-made goods simply aren't competitive, either in price or quality or both. We committed ourselves to seeing if we could do anything to improve the situation. The remedy we envisioned wasn't some blind patriotic idea that preaches buying American at any cost. We, like any other retailer, will only buy American if those goods can be produced efficiently enough to offer good value. We're not interested in charity here. We don't believe in subsidizing substandard work or inefficiency. So our primary goal became to work with American manufacturers and see if our formidable buying power could help them deliver the goods and in the process save some American manufacturing jobs. I sent out an open letter to our suppliers inviting them to work with us on the program. Walmart believes American workers can make the difference, I told them, if management provides the leadership. We were surprised ourselves at the results. It turned out that if Walmart committed to high-volume purchases well in advance of shipping deadlines, a lot of American manufacturers could save enough on the purchase of materials, personnel scheduling, and inventory costs to realize significant efficiency gains. So, in fact, they could turn out a wide variety of merchandise, flannel shirts, candles, men's knit shirts, ladies' sweaters, bicycles, beach towels, film, videotapes, furniture, even toys at competitive prices. We also took a close look at our overseas buying practices and discovered a number of hidden costs, such as having to own inventory from the time it leaves port on a ship. Using that data, we developed a formula which enabled us to make a true apples-to-apples cost comparison of buying something overseas versus buying it at home. Now, if we can get within 5% of the same price and quality, we take a smaller markup and go with the American product. What we learned was that we had fallen into a pattern of knee-jerk import buying without really examining possible alternatives. In the past, we would just take our best-selling U.S.-made items, send them to the Orient, and say, "See if you can make something like this. We could use 100,000 units of this or more if the quality holds up." I'm sure a lot of other retailers do the same thing. Today, we instruct our buyers to make trips to places like Greenville, South Carolina, Dothan, Alabama, Aurora, Missouri, and hundreds of other out-of-the-way places in Pennsylvania, New York, Ohio, or New Hampshire, before just routinely dashing off a letter of credit to the Far East. If we could all take a little extra trouble to work some of these deals out, and the manufacturers will continue to come up with their own creative programs, I think there's still a tremendous amount of untapped potential left in this idea. As usual, some of our critics, mostly unions in this case, took a shot at me for this idea. They said I was wrapping myself in the flag and pulling a typical Sam Walton promotion to hide the fact that we sell a lot of import goods. These folks, I'm afraid, are really living in the past. They don't believe in a free market. They're not interested in new solutions. And they only care about jobs if they are union jobs, many of which, frankly, have priced themselves out of the market either with unrealistic wages or total inflexibility. With this approach, we estimate we have saved or created almost 100,000 American manufacturing jobs. So before anybody dismisses Bring It Home as a publicity stunt, they should listen to the people whose jobs were saved or created by the program. Ferris Burroughs, President, Ferris Fashions, Brinkley, Arkansas. "It's the best thing that ever happened to Brinkley, and certainly the best thing that ever happened to me. Before, we had a contract with Van Heusen for Penney's and Sears, but in 1984 they told us they were moving everything to China. We were struggling from season to season with 90 jobs when I got this call from a guy claiming to be Sam Walton. It turns out he actually was Sam Walton, and he wanted to know if we thought we could make 50,000 dozen flannel shirts for him. I'll tell you what, though, he's the only guy I ever worked for who looked me right in the eye and said, 'Son, if you can't make money off this project, don't do it.' Most retailers couldn't care less whether the manufacturer makes money or not. Anyway, today we're making about 2.5 million Walmart shirts, and we've gone from 90 employees the week Mr. Sam called to 320 today. And we know where it comes from. Every Christmas, we give our employees Walmart gift certificates. There's no charity at all involved in this program, and in fact, I'm proud to say that it benefits us at Walmart in a very direct way. Every job we save creates another potential Walmart customer who's not worrying about where his or her next dollar is coming from. They have a job, and we have a customer. So we all come out ahead. Ferris was one of our early success stories, and since then we've worked out all kinds of Buy American deals with small and large manufacturers, including Fieldcrest Cannon, 3M, Sunbeam, Miro Foley, U.S. Electronics, Ken Togs, Capital Mercury, Mr. Coffee, Lasco, and Huffy. From the time the program began in 1985 until the end of last year, 1991, we estimate that we bought American-made goods with a retail value of more than $5 billion that would previously have been purchased overseas. And just to keep everybody thinking along these lines, we always post our latest tally and our latest bring-it-home success story right by the door where all our vendors have to enter our building to make sales calls. In the same spirit, we're in the early stages of an environmental initiative, encouraging suppliers and manufacturers to eliminate any wasteful practices, such as unnecessary packaging, that we can. Also, we have a fairly new program in which we donate 2% from purchases of Sam's American Choice products, a selection of our own private label products, toward scholarships for students studying mathematics, hard sciences, and computer sciences. We aren't the least bit naive about how big a stick Walmart swings in the world of retailing these days. We know we can be very influential, powerful, if you prefer. So today, I think it's important for our people to remember that things aren't the same as the old days, when we were the scrappy underdog having to fight for every single break. We still want to drive a hard bargain, but now we need to guard against abusing our power. We want to find more ways, like Bring It Home, in which we can use our influence to give something back. Chapter 17. Running a Successful Company. 10 Rules That Worked For Me. One thing you'll notice if you spend very much time talking with Sam about Walmart's success, he's always saying things like, "This was the key to the whole thing," or "That was our real secret." He knows as well as anyone that there wasn't any magic formula. A lot of different things made it work. And in one day's time, he may cite all of them as the key or the secret. What's amazing is that for almost 50 years, he's managed to focus on all of them at once, all the time. That's his real secret. David Glass. I think we've covered the story of how all my partners and associates and I over the years built Walmart into what it is today. And in the telling, I think we've covered all the principles which resulted in the company's amazing success. A whole lot has changed about the retailing business in the 47 years we've been in it, including some of my theories. We've changed our minds about some significant things along the way, and adopted some new principles, particularly about the concept of partnership in a corporation. But most of the values and the rules and the techniques we've relied on have stayed the same the whole way. Some of them are such simple, common-sense old favorites that they hardly seem worth mentioning. This isn't the first time that I've been asked to come up with a list of rules for success, but it is the first time I've actually sat down and done it. I'm glad I did, because it's been a revealing exercise for me. The truth is, David Glass is right. I do seem to have a couple of dozen things that I've singled out at one time or another as the key to the whole thing. One I don't even have on my list is work hard. If you don't know that already, or you're not willing to do it, you probably won't be going far enough to need my list anyway. And another I didn't include on the list is the idea of building a team. If you want to build an enterprise of any size at all, it almost goes without saying that you absolutely must create a team of people who work together and give real meaning to that overused word, teamwork. To me, that's more the goal of the whole thing, rather than some way to get there. I believe in always having goals and always setting them high. I can certainly tell you that the folks at Walmart have always had goals in front of them. In fact, we have sometimes built real scoreboards on the stage at Saturday morning meetings. One more thing, if you're really looking for my advice here, trying to get something serious out of this exercise I put myself through, remember, these rules are not in any way intended to be the Ten Commandments of business. There's some rules that work for me, but I always prided myself on breaking everybody else's rules, and I always favored the mavericks who challenged my rules. I may have fought them all the way, but I respected them, and in the end, I listened to them a lot more closely than I did the pack who always agreed with everything I said. So pay special attention to Rule 10. And if you interpret it in the right spirit, as it applies to you, it could mean simply, break all the rules. For what they're worth, here they are. Sam's Rules for Building a Business. Rule 1. Commit to your business. Believe in it more than anybody else. I think I overcame every single one of my personal shortcomings by the sheer passion I brought to my work. I don't know if you're born with this kind of passion or if you can learn it, but I do know you need it. If you love your work, you'll be out there every day trying to do it the best you possibly can. And pretty soon, everybody around will catch the passion from you, like a fever. Rule 2. Share your profits with all your associates, and treat them as partners. In turn, they will treat you as a partner, and together you will all perform beyond your wildest expectations. Remain a corporation and retain control if you like, but behave as a servant leader in a partnership. Encourage your associates to hold a stake in the company. Offer discounted stock and grant them stock for their retirement. It's the single best thing we ever did. Rule 3. Motivate your partners. Money and ownership alone aren't enough. Constantly, day by day, think of new and more interesting ways to motivate and challenge your partners. Set high goals, encourage competition, and then keep score. Make bets with outrageous payoffs. If things get stale, cross-pollinate. Have managers switch jobs with one another to stay challenged. Keep everybody guessing as to what your next trick is going to be. Don't become too predictable. Rule 4. Communicate everything you possibly can to your partners. The more they know, the more they'll understand. The more they understand, the more they'll care. Once they care, there's no stopping them. If you don't trust your associates to know what's going on, they'll know you don't really consider them partners. Information is power, and the gain you get from empowering your associates more than offsets the risk of informing your competitors. Rule 5. Appreciate everything your associates do for the business. A paycheck and a stock option will buy one kind of loyalty. But all of us like to be told how much somebody appreciates what we do for them. We like to hear it often, and especially when we have done something we're really proud of. Nothing else can quite substitute for a few well-chosen, well-timed, sincere words of praise. They are absolutely free and worth a fortune. Rule 6. Celebrate your successes. Find some humor in your failures. Don't take yourself so seriously. Loosen up, and everybody around you will loosen up. Have fun. Show enthusiasm, always. When all else fails, put on a costume and sing a silly song. Then make everybody else sing with you. Don't do a hula on Wall Street. It's been done. Think up your own stunt. All of this is more important and more fun than you think, and it really fools the competition. Why should we take those cornballs at Walmart seriously? Rule 7. Listen to everyone in your company and figure out ways to get them talking. The folks on the front lines, the ones who actually talk to the customer, are the only ones who really know what's going on out there. You'd better find out what they know. This really is what total quality is all about. To push responsibility down in your organization and to force good ideas to bubble up within it, you must listen to what your associates are trying to tell you. Rule 8. Exceed your customers' expectations. If you do, they'll come back over and over. Give them what they want and a little more. Let them know you appreciate them. Make good on all your mistakes and don't make excuses. Apologize. Stand behind everything you do. The two most important words I ever wrote were on that first Walmart sign, satisfaction guaranteed. They're still up there, and they have made all the difference. Rule 9. Control your expenses better than your competition. This is where you can always find the competitive advantage. For 25 years running, long before Walmart was known as the nation's largest retailer, we ranked number one in our industry for the lowest ratio of expenses to sales. You can make a lot of different mistakes and still recover if you run an efficient operation. Or you can be brilliant and still go out of business if you're too inefficient. Rule 10. Swim upstream. Go the other way. Ignore the conventional wisdom. If everybody else is doing it one way, there's a good chance you can find your niche by going in exactly the opposite direction. But be prepared for a lot of folks to wave you down and tell you you're headed the wrong way. I guess in all my years, what I heard more often than anything was, a town of less than 50,000 population cannot support a discount store for very long. Those are some pretty ordinary rules, some would say even simplistic. The hard part, the real challenge, is to constantly figure out ways to execute them. You can't just keep doing what works one time, because everything around you is always changing. To succeed, you have to stay out in front of that change. Chapter 18. Wanting to Leave a Legacy. With the possible exception of Henry Ford, Sam Walton is the entrepreneur of the century. Tom Peters, co-author of In Search of Excellence. By now, it's probably clear to you that I've devoted most of my life to Walmart, starting it, growing it, and always refining the concept of this whole phenomenon. My life has been full and fun and challenging and rewarding beyond even my wildest expectations. I've pretty much gotten my own way for the whole run, While a lot of people were working away at jobs they might not have particularly enjoyed, I was having the time of my life. If I wasn't in the stores trying to pump up our associates to do an even better job, or in the office looking over numbers to see where the next trouble spot was going to pop up, or leading cheers at a Saturday morning meeting, I was probably at the stick of my airplane, looking out over some part of this beautiful country of ours, and checking out the number of cars in those Kmart parking lots. Or maybe I was taking a few hours off to get in some tennis, or to hunt with my dogs. All that has wound down for me now. I'm really sick these days. And I guess when you get older and illness catches up with you, you naturally turn a little bit philosophical, especially late at night when you can't sleep, and your mind is turning everything over and over trying to take stock of where you've been and what you've done. The truth is that if I hadn't gotten sick, I doubt I would have written this book or taken the time to try to sort my life out. As you now know, temperamentally, I'm much too biased toward action to undertake such a sedentary project. But since I have, I'm going to go all the way and try to share with you how I feel about some things that seem important to me. This will sound strange to people who know me well, but lately I've wondered if I should feel bad about having been so wholly committed to Walmart. Was it really worth all the time I spent away from my family? Should I have driven my partners so hard all these years? Am I really leaving behind something on this earth that I can be proud of having accomplished? Or does it somehow lack meaning to me now that I'm facing the ultimate challenge? We could have gone a lot of different ways at several points. Many folks started out in retailing just like I did, and built their companies up to a point, and then said, I've had enough, and sold out and bought an island. I could have kicked back and played with the grandchildren, or I could have devoted the latter years of my life to good works, I guess. I don't know that anybody else has ever done it quite like me. Started out as a pure neophyte, learned his trade, swept the floor, kept the books, trimmed the windows, weighed the candy, rung the cash register, installed the fixtures, remodeled the stores, built an organization of this size and quality, and kept on doing it right up to the end because they enjoyed it so much. No one that I know of has done it that way. Here's how I look at it. My life has been a trade-off. If I wanted to reach the goals I set for myself, I had to get at it and stay at it every day. I had to think about it all the time. And I guess what David Glass said about me is true. I had to get up every day with my mind set on improving something. Charlie Baum was right, too, when he said I was driven by a desire to always be on the top of the heap. But in the larger sense, the life and death sense, did I make the right choices? Having now thought about this a lot, I can honestly say that if I had the choices to make all over again, I would make just about the same ones. Preachers are put here to minister to our souls, doctors to heal our diseases, teachers to open up our minds, and so on. Everybody has their role to play. The thing is, I am absolutely convinced that the only way we can improve one another's quality of life, which is something very real to those of us who grew up in the Depression, is through what we call free enterprise, practiced correctly and morally. And I really believe there haven't been many companies that could have done the things we've done at Walmart. We've improved the standard of living of our customers, whom we've saved billions of dollars, and of our associates, who have been able to share profits. Many of both groups have also invested in our stock and profited all through the years. When we started out, the whole idea was nothing but a pure profit motive. Our business strategy was to bring the customers into the tent by selling the highest quality goods we could at the lowest possible prices. It worked. And those few of us who believed in it from early on and invested in the idea, got rich off it. Obviously, everybody who went to work in a Walmart didn't get rich. But there have been many stories over the years of associates who've made enough at least to buy their first car or own their first home, and we've had several associates who've retired with over $1 million in profit sharing. We've been able to help our associates to a greater degree than most companies because of what you'd have to call enlightened self-interest. We were selfish enough to see in the beginning the value to the company of letting them share the profits. Also, I think those associates in our company who believe in our ideals and our goals and get with the program have felt some spiritual satisfaction, in the psychological rather than the religious sense, out of the whole experience. They learn to stand up tall and look people in the eye and speak to them, and they feel better about themselves. And once they start gaining confidence, there's no reason they can't keep on improving themselves. Many of them decide they want to go to college or to manage a store, or take what they've learned and start their own business, or do a good job and take pride in that. Walmart has helped their pocketbooks and their self-esteem. There are certainly some union folks and some middlemen out there who wouldn't agree with me. But I believe that millions of people are better off today than they would have been if Walmart had never existed. So I am just awfully proud of the whole deal, and I feel good about how I chose to expend my energies in this life. I know one thing for sure. We certainly changed the way retail works in this country. And when I say we, I don't mean just Walmart. Some of the fellows I told you about early in the book, like Saul Price and Harry Cunningham and John Geis, deserve a lot of the credit, too. The whole philosophy has changed in the retail business because of the quality discounters, of whom I believe we are the very best. Almost from the beginning, our objective has been to charge just as little as possible for our merchandise and to try and use what muscle we've had to work out deals with our suppliers so we can offer the very best quality we can. Many people in this business are still trying to charge whatever the traffic will bear, and they're simply on the wrong track. I'll tell you this, those companies out there who aren't thinking about the customer and focusing on the customer's interests are just going to get lost in the shuffle, if they haven't already. Those who get greedy are going to be left in the dust. There are lessons in what's happened at Walmart that go beyond retail and apply to many other businesses. You start with a given. Free enterprise is the engine of our society. Communism is pretty much down the drain and proven so, and there doesn't appear to be anything else it can compare to a free society based on a market economy. Nothing can touch that system, not unless leadership and management get selfish or lazy. In the future, free enterprise is going to have to be done well, which means it benefits the workers, the stockholders, the communities, and, of course, management, which must adopt a philosophy of servant leadership. Recently, I don't think there's any doubt that a lot of American management has bent over too far toward taking care of itself first and worrying about everybody else later. The Japanese are right on this point. You can't create a team spirit when the situation is so one-sided, when management gets so much and workers get so little of the pie. Some of these salaries I see out there are completely out of line, and everybody knows it. It's obvious that most companies would be much better served by basing managers' pay on the performance of the company or return on investment to the shareholders or some yardstick which clearly takes into account how well they're doing their job. And the formula has to make sure that profits are divided fairly among workers, management, and stockholders, according to their contributions and risks. At Walmart, we've always paid our executives less than industry standards, sometimes maybe too much less. But we've always rewarded them with stock bonuses and other incentives related directly to the performance of the company. It's no coincidence that the company has done really well, and so have they. I believe our way of looking at things is going to come into its own in this decade and the next century. The way business is conducted worldwide is going to be different. And a lot of that difference is going to reflect what we egotistically think of as the Walmart way. In the global economy, successful business is going to do just what Walmart is always trying to do, give more and more responsibility for making decisions to the people who are actually on the firing line, those who deal with the customers every day. Good management is going to start listening to the ideas of these line soldiers, pooling these ideas and disseminating them around their organizations so people can act on them. That's the way the successful companies out there already are doing it, the 3Ms, the Hewlett-Packards, the GEs, the Walmarts. Great ideas come from everywhere if you just listen and look for them. You never know who's going to have a great idea. We can turn the whole world around just the way we've done it in retail. We can do it better than the Japanese because we're more innovative. We're more creative. We can compete with labor in Bangladesh or wherever because we have better technology, which can give us more efficient equipment. We can get beyond a lot of our old adversarial relationships and establish win-win partnerships with our suppliers and our workers, which will leave us with more energy and talent to focus on the important thing, meeting the needs of our customers. But all this requires overcoming one of the most powerful forces in human nature, the resistance to change. To succeed in this world, you have to change all the time. When you look at what's happened to the American auto industry, it's tempting to want to treat the Japanese unfairly, the way they treat us with their protectionist laws. Our auto industry doesn't play on level ground, but I don't think we should counter with protectionism because it doesn't address the real problem. The quality of our product doesn't compete with that of the Japanese, whether we want to admit it or not. The challenge is a great one for management. What they have to do is build a partnership with their people. I understand that this industry has all kinds of problems we haven't seen in ours. I know that U.S. auto workers make $22 an hour versus $16 in Japan, and that Mexican auto workers earn much less. I'm not saying I could solve all these problems, but I'd love to have the fun of trying to take a unionized company today and sell its people on the idea of having to be competitive globally, whether it was in autos or steel or electronics. I'd love a chance at that, the pleasure of seeing if they could be motivated into a team that would share in all the company's success and still have a union. It would take a powerful lot of persuading to pull this off, but I guarantee it could be accomplished by somebody obsessed and persistent enough. But if American management is going to say to their workers that we're all in this together, they're going to have to stop this foolishness of paying themselves $3 million and $4 million bonuses every year, and riding around everywhere in limos and corporate jets like they're so much better than everybody else. I'm not saying that every company should necessarily be as chintzy as Walmart. Everybody's not in the discount business, consumed by trying to save every possible dollar for their customers. But I wonder if a lot of these companies wouldn't do just as well if their executives lived a little more like real folks. A lot of people think it's crazy of me to fly coach whenever I go on a commercial flight, and maybe I do overdo it a little bit. But I feel like it's up to me as a leader to set an example. It's not fair for me to ride one way and ask everybody else to ride another way. The minute you do that, you start building resentment, and your whole team idea begins to strain at the seams. But now, it's time for me to forget about all that's past and think about what I really want the legacy of Walmart to be in the future. I'd like to believe that as Walmart continues to thrive and grow, it can come to live up to what someone once called us the Lighthouse of the Ozarks. Only I hope we can spread the concept further than our home region here in the foothills, because we're really a national company now. For Walmart to maintain its position in the hearts of our customers, we have to study more ways we can give something back to our communities. I'm tremendously proud of the things we've done that I've already mentioned, and we're already studying ways we can go further to stay involved, to be more socially conscious all around. As I've said, our country desperately needs a revolution in education, and I hope Walmart can contribute at some level, if for no other reason than selfish ones. Without a strong educational system, the very free enterprise system that allows a Walmart or an IBM or a Procter & Gamble to appear on the scene and strengthen our nation's economy simply won't work. You may have trouble believing it, but every time we've tested the old saying, it has paid off for us in spades. The more you give, the more you get. Finally, a lot of folks ask me two related questions all the time. The first one is, could a Walmart-type story still occur in this day and age? My answer is, of course it could happen again. Somewhere out there right now, there's someone, probably hundreds of thousands of someones, with good enough ideas to go all the way. It will be done again, over and over, providing that someone wants it badly enough to do what it takes to get there. It's all a matter of attitude and the capacity to constantly study and question the management of the business. The second question is, if I were a young man or woman starting out today with the same sorts of talents and energies and aspirations that I had 50 years ago, what would I do? The answer to that is a little harder to figure out. I don't know exactly what I would do today, but I feel pretty sure I would be selling something, and I expect it would be at the retail level, where I could relate directly to customers off the street. I think I'd study the retail field today and go into the business that offered the most promise for the least amount of money. Probably some kind of specialty retail. Something to do with computers, maybe. Or something like The Gap. Even The Body Shop. Anyway, the next time some overeager, slightly eccentric shopkeeper opens up a business in your neck of the woods, before you write him off too quickly, remember those two old codgers who gave me maybe 60 days to last in my dime store down in Fayetteville. Go check the new store out. See what they've got to offer. See how they treat you. And decide for yourself if you ever want to go back. Because this is what it's really all about. In this free country of ours, that shopkeeper's success is entirely up to you, the customer. A postscript. For the last 2 years of Dad's life, he fought a difficult battle against a form of bone cancer, multiple myeloma, which from the time of diagnosis he understood would almost certainly prove fatal. Like every other challenge he encountered in his life, he met this one head-on, full of optimism and ready to try new ways of conquering the problem. So with the encouragement of the whole family and the meticulous hands-on medical care management of my brother John, Dad embarked on a variety of experimental treatment programs with a group of excellent doctors. He took his medicine, but he never dwelled on either the illness that had befallen him or its potential cures. Rather, he seized the day. At the time of the diagnosis in early 1990, he'd been working somewhat ambivalently on an autobiography. He canceled that project, choosing instead to spend most of his time and energy doing what he enjoyed most, flying his plane from town to town, going from Walmart to Walmart, visiting with his beloved associates. Toward the end of 1991, when he began to realize that his illness was catching up with him and would soon limit his mobility, Dad, at the urging of our family and others, again turned his attention to the idea of putting his story down on paper while he still could. Once he decided to write it, he threw himself into this book project with the same focus and energy he applied to everything he did in life. He was very particular about what he wanted his book to be, and he worked at it daily, making revisions, adding anecdotes, refining style points, urging others to contribute their memories. By early March, his spirits remained high as he continued work on the book, but his physical condition was worsening. Then he received one of the great surprises of his life. The White House wanted to present him with the Presidential Medal of Freedom, our nation's highest civilian award. President Bush and the First Lady would be traveling to Bentonville to present the medal to Dad, and he was thrilled by the honor. At such an occasion, of course, Dad could have invited anyone he wanted to attend the ceremony, but we hardly had to ask whom he wanted to be there with him. His Walmart associates. The award was presented on the morning of Tuesday, March 17, in the auditorium of the Walmart General Offices, where Dad had held forth on so many Saturday mornings. The room was filled with several hundred of his associates, and their affection for Dad on this special day was particularly moving. They really outdid themselves, and I think they may even have startled President and Mrs. Bush, not to mention the White House press corps, by giving one of the most enthusiastic Walmart cheers we've heard around here in some time. Dad's pleasure was evident, and he called it the highlight of our entire career. Of course, he shared all the credit with his associates. But it was a poignant day. He had to be rolled onto the stage in a wheelchair, and I think most of the associates sensed that it would be their last get-together with him. The room was full of pride that day, but also lots of memories and many tears. Here is what the presidential citation said of Dad. An American original, Sam Walton embodies the entrepreneurial spirit and epitomizes the American dream. Concern for his employees, a commitment to his community, and a desire to make a difference have been the hallmarks of his career. By sponsoring scholarships for Latin America, he has also worked to bring peoples closer together and to share with others the American ideals he so well represents. A devoted family man, business leader, and statesman for democracy, Sam Walton demonstrates the virtues of faith, hope, and hard work. America honors this captain of commerce as successful in life as in business. A few days later, Dad entered the University of Arkansas Hospital in Little Rock. Even in the final weeks of his life, he took great pleasure in doing what he had always done. One of the last people he spoke with outside the family was a local Walmart manager who, at our request, dropped by to chat with Dad about his store's sales figures for the week. Then, less than 3 weeks after receiving the Medal of Freedom, and just days after his 74th birthday, Dad's struggle with cancer finally ended. On Sunday morning, April 5th, he died peacefully, as inspirational in facing death as he had been in facing life. We will all miss him. Rob Walton, Chairman, Walmart Stores, Bentonville, Arkansas, May 1992. The End. This book was read for you by Henry Strozier, a member of SAG-AFTRA. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Sam Walton, Made in America, by Sam Walton with John Huey. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.